This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. This week, hot pink is the new color on the streets of Beirut. Women are driving pink taxis and driving down business for male cab drivers.
Before I was have many customers, foreign customers. In these times, nobody called me. Yeah, they call a new one.
The pink taxis offer safe, clean rides for women only.
I'm at ease because I'm accompanied by a woman. I sometimes find men hard to handle. And pink, it's my favorite color.
And fighting corruption in Kenya, we hear the story of a high-profile whistleblower. Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Bomb blasts in Ramadi a few days ago killed 19 people and injured 80 more. It's a sobering reminder that violence in Iraq continues to devastate people's lives. Bomb blast victims often have to cope with debilitating physical injuries. Psychological damage is less visible, but it can be as bad or worse than some physical scars. In Jordan, Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, has treated more than 1,000 injured Iraqis in the last 3 years. About a third of them are children. Reporter Dale Gavlak met an MSF psychologist who specializes in healing children's wounds from the inside out. She filed this report from Amman.
7-year-old Hussein and 16-year-old Alawi are doing what they like best, playing soccer. But instead of their legs, they're using a PlayStation game to make their tricky moves. Alawi once dreamed of becoming a professional soccer player, but those dreams were dashed earlier this year by a blast in Baghdad. Alawi is shy about speaking about his injury, so one of the MSF staff explains what happened.
They had exams, and he was leaving, going home from school, and there was a car that had explosives inside. It blew up at the top of the street.
The explosion also tore off the bottom half of Alawi's right leg. As for 7-year-old Hussein, he was just a baby when a bomb struck, as his mother explains.
He was with his grandmother. He was 1 year, 7 months old, and they were in the market. He was holding him, and then there was a bomb. A car exploded next to them, so his grandmother died. She was holding him in her arms, and she basically threw him due to the explosion.
These children and others wounded in the conflict were referred to MSF for medical treatment in Jordan. And the MSF psychologist here, Yusuf Masalem, helps heal their inner wounds.
Mostly the young children, we find a fear. They isolate themselves or they didn't trust the others. With the, let's say, oldest, they had other kind of problem like feeling shame or to have a low self-esteem because, after the accident, he feels he can't do the same thing that he can do.
Dr. Masalem says the children can be depressed and their relationships with friends and family can be difficult. So he uses play and group therapy, as well as art and social activities, to help them. Today, Hussein and Alawi travel up a creaky elevator to the 6th floor in the Qasr Jeddah Hotel, where Dr. Masalem holds his sessions. The boys are joining him for group therapy with two other children, a girl named Athra and a boy, Haider, both 15 years old. Dr. Masalem says that today's session is about stress. Just as there is physical weight that we can or cannot carry, he says so too there is psychological pressure that can be difficult to bear. Seven-year-old Hussein interjects. He says it's like the cartoon Tom and Jerry. Sometimes Tom and Jerry can carry everything. Other times they can't lift a tomato. Dr. Masalem chuckles and turns to Haider, a boy who had both legs injured when a bomb exploded in his family's garden. Haider says his wounds were a heavy psychological blow for him, but little by little he is managing to adjust. He has had more than 20 operations to improve his ability to walk, now with crutches, but he misses running. Adra gets choked up when she explains her loss. Her father, sister, and brother were killed when a missile struck their home. Dr. Masalem tells Adra that although the grief she is experiencing is normal, it is not easy, and expresses his sympathy for her loss. He encourages the children to think about how they can replace some of the things they once did with new activities. This will bring new hope, he says. Alawi, who had hoped to play professional soccer, says he now uses his crutches to hit the ball. Anybody can experience a catastrophe, he says. God forbid an injury. You must start a new chapter in your life. He says he is now strengthening his upper body to compensate for his loss of movement. Dr. Masalem suggests that this little group can share some fun activities while they're healing in Amman. Dr. Masalem says at times his work as a healer is particularly difficult because of the severe cases he's trying to treat.
Sometimes when you see really a very hard situation, that like a girl, she's 12 years old and 70% from her body is burned. This is really a big challenge because Whatever you work, there's a lot of part. It's need time, it's need support, it's need a lot of things.
All these children eventually return to Iraq, where access to psychological help is limited. Dr. Masalem has stayed in contact with some of them, but he also gives the families guidance before they leave.
We follow them psychologically, the family, and we try to make some education how to deal with this child.
Regardless, Dr. Masalem says some of his young patients will need years to heal. For the World Vision Report, I'm Dale Gavlak in Amman, Jordan.
We stay in the Middle East now, but head west to Beirut, where the traffic is bad, very bad. It's a challenge to get around in this bustling city. There's hardly any public transport. Taxis are notoriously unregulated and usually driven by men. So getting into a taxi, especially at night, is something most women avoid. Until now. Don Duncan has more from Beirut.
The banged-up 1970s Mercedes taxis that choke Beirut's streets are an institution to themselves. Cabby Ibrahim Haysham has been driving one for 35 years. He can take you across town for as little as $2.
This car is a strong car. It's good iron, good engine, good movement.
But that $2 gets you a crowded, noisy ride where people jump in and out of the public taxi at any given moment. And it often comes with the added pleasure of Ibrahim's secondhand smoke. So more and more Beirutis are deciding to pay a little more to take one of the growing number of modern taxis that are taking over the city's streets. These new cabs come with air conditioning, comfortable seats and clean air. And Ibrahim is feeling the pinch.
Before I was have many customers, foreign customers. In these times, nobody called me. Yeah, they call a new one.
And a new rival has joined the fray. It's Hot Pink. That's the sound of Banet Taxi, which means girls taxi in Arabic. It's a service by women for women. And it's opening up job opportunities for women in Beirut. Women like Maya Bouhaidi.
This is my car. I like this work. It's easy work.
You can't miss Maya and her colleagues. Their pink taxis are turning heads all over Beirut, as is their dress sense. Sharp white shirts, pink ties, complete with a pink flower in their neatly put together hair.
I have created a clear professional field for women in Lebanon over 30.
That's businesswoman Nawal Fakri, founder of Banet Taxi.
I put my workers in a feminine context. All my drivers are clean and elegant.
But aesthetics aside, they are also offering something new, a safer transport option in a country that has no shortage of women who are skittish about taking taxis on their own.
The first time I was at danger in a cab, I was around 14. I was turning 15. And I had decided to get into a cab to go home at around 10:30 at night.
That's Yasmin Hajar, a 25-year-old student from Beirut.
I gave him my address. So he's like, okay, I'm taking a shortcut. So he goes and he starts driving away. I was like, this is not the way to my house. It's not where I asked for. He's like, yeah, I know. I just need to pick up something. And I was like, to drop me off, I'll get into another cab. He's like, no, stay. And he locked the doors.
Yasmin then had to pull a pocket knife on the cab driver. Her father had given her the knife with such dangers in mind. Hajar is among many women here who say Banet Taxi is a welcome arrival, and like similar taxi services started recently in Dubai, Tehran and Cairo, the pink taxis are meeting with huge success here. Nawal Fakhri says her business has grown tenfold since launching in March.
I start just with 3 drivers, but now I have 12 drivers. I prepare to put in the market 20 cars.
Lamia Samaha is a recent convert to Banet Taxi. She says she's never going back to the regular taxi again.
I'm at ease because I'm accompanied by a woman. I sometimes find men hard to handle. And pink, it's my favorite color.
And Lebanon's tourist season will probably drive up the demand for taxis even more. That's because many of those visitors will be from conservative Muslim countries.
The women from the Gulf who come here are a bonus for me.
Those women are forbidden to travel with any man other than a close relative, so they're prime candidates for Banet Taxi. But when the tourism season dies down, Fakhri is confident domestic demand for the service will continue to grow. Lina Abu Habib agrees. She's one of Lebanon's main women rights activists.
As a feminist, I do not believe in segregation, but as a feminist also, I think everybody has a right to a safe space.
So it looks like there is going to be a lot more pink in the streets of Beirut. Even in his noisy, smoky cab, Ibrahim Hesham seems to be coming around to the idea of women taxi drivers making inroads in his city.
They drive well.
Women are good drivers, Hesham says, sometimes even better than men. For the World Vision Report, I'm Dawn Duncan in Beirut.
When Kenyans say, it's our turn to eat, it's not food they're talking about, it's kickbacks. Hear about one man's fight against corruption, coming up next on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Kenya's anti-corruption chief quit a couple of weeks ago in response to public protests. Critics said the chief had done nothing to change the culture of bribery and corruption that exists in Kenya. One man tried to clean up Kenyan corruption just a few years ago, and he ended up fleeing the country for his life. His name was John Githongo. He'd been appointed by the Kenyan president to root out corruption, but he only lasted a couple of years before blowing the whistle on his own bosses. Githongo's dramatic story of uncovering corruption in the highest places has been captured in a new book that reads like a thriller. The author is journalist Michaela Wrong, who had befriended Githongo when she worked as a foreign correspondent in Kenya. Here's Michaela Wrong reading an excerpt from her book titled, It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower. This was the day John Githongo showed up on her London doorstep.
He came bearing toxic material. A nervous tremor scurried along my spine as he explained that he had done the unthinkable, wiring himself for sound in classic police informer style, taping the self-incriminating conversations of the ministers who were supposed to be his trusted workmates. The explosive contents of those recordings had been systematically downloaded onto his computer, which now sat quietly in my spare bedroom. It might be an idea, he said, for me to find a third party to take the computer while I work out what I'm going to do. Suddenly, I was plunged into an unfamiliar world, of covering my tracks, watching what I said. In this world of subterfuge, even the simplest procedure grew vastly complex. Sitting at my computer, John wasted no time in typing out his resignation letter. He drafted it slowly and carefully. While he did not want to give anything away that might constrain his actions later on, he was also determined to make it clear to the careful reader that he was not leaving happy in the knowledge of a job well done. There would be no spending more time with my family cliches. The circumstances of his resignation alone, announced on a one-way trip into exile, must at this stage do the rest for him, sending a damning message about the true nature of the NARC regime.
Makela Rong is with us to talk more about this story. Thanks for joining us, Makela.
It's a pleasure.
What's going on here in this section of the book?
Really, this is the moment where John had turned up on my doorstep in London, arriving fairly unexpectedly. I told him that he was very welcome to come and stay because it was clear that things were going a little wrong for him over in Kenya. And he turned up and told me that he wanted to resign his job as the anti-corruption czar in the Kenyan government. And then I suddenly realised I'd been plunged into this very confusing situation because he was on the run. He didn't want anyone to know that he was staying with me and he didn't want to be traced. It was just my experience of entering into that very shadowy world of somebody who's trying to keep their whereabouts very hidden and believes that people are following him and trying to track him down.
Yeah, it's like an espionage novel. Now, John comes to your doorstep. You two had been friends. I know that's a longer story than you can explain in a couple minutes, but what was it John told you had happened that he had to leave the country and go into hiding?
Well, at the time, he didn't explain. It was only later on when he decided to go public that he told me the full story. What had happened was that after the first 2 years of doing this job as anti-corruption czar, he had come across a growing number of dodgy contracts that were being signed off by ministers in his own government. They were all military and security contracts. And behind these contracts, there didn't lie any real substance. These were vastly overpriced contracts for sort of helicopters and prison telecommunications and passport systems, and nothing was going to be delivered at the end of them. What was happening is the money was going out of the Kenyan treasury. It was then disappearing and almost certainly coming back, being paid into the accounts of the people who had signed off, the ministers and the permanent secretaries who had signed the contract. So it was a sort of circular scam.
And what's so surprising about this is that the new president of Kenya had actually hired John to root out corruption. It was supposed to be a whole new era in Kenyan politics. What went wrong?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this had been one of the key parts of the presidential campaign. Mwai Kibaki's presidential campaign in 2002 was, we're going to do away with 24 years of corruption. We're the new broom, you know, we're going to clean it all out. And I think this is why it was such a shock to John, because he suddenly realised that the ministers who were closest to him, who were closest to the president, were involved in this new scam. It was known as the Anglo leasing scam after one of the firms involved. And that they were all coming to him and saying, John, you will keep quiet about this. You're not going to investigate this, are you? Because, you know, it's us. So they were turning to him and expecting him not to do the job that he'd been appointed to do because he was part of that ethnic community. He was part of that Kikuyu, Meru and Embu community.
The whole tribal system of loyalty and corruption is something that is deeply rooted in Kenyan culture. How does that play into government corruption?
Well, I think it's the form that corruption takes in Kenya. And it's what I try and explain in my book is that this isn't a new phenomena. This is something that dates back to before independence, because you could say that the white settlers, the British settlers, who first created the nation state of Kenya in East Africa, they were the first ones who started it because they ran the place for the benefit of one racial minority, which was the white settlers. And then when independence came along, you had a Kikuyu president, Jomo Kenyatta, who very much saw this as, you know, we're taking over from the white settlers and we are running a country of 48 separate tribal communities. But really, we're going to come out top. We're going to get all the advantages, the best land, the best jobs. And then, you know, when he dies and President Daniel Arap Moi takes over, it becomes the Kalenjin elite that rules the country in that way. And so you have this series of tribal elites taking over and just running the place as though it's their fiefdom. It's smash and grab. It's fill your pockets while you're there. And if you don't happen to have somebody from your tribal community who either gets a ministerial place or gets the top job of the presidency, then you're left out in the cold. And being out in the cold in a place like Kenya means you don't get any investment. You don't get any jobs in the ministries. You don't get any places in the civil service. So it's a very, very grim destiny.
So this explains the title of your book, which is called It's Our Turn to Eat.
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is a phrase you hear all the time in Kenya. I came to really loathe it. And I think it's also something that actually sort of a philosophy that sort of disgusted John, who is very moralistic. He's a very religious person. And he came to feel that this it's our turn to eat philosophy, that people were constantly turning to him and say, but it's our turn, John. You know, we were out in the cold while Moy ran the country for the Kalenjins. He found it repellent because he's a young, modern Kenyan. And he's saying, hang on, you know, this, I thought we were going to do away with that way of running the country. I thought we were going to be running it for every Kenyan citizen, and you know, that we were working in a meritocracy, and that if you're good at your job, well, you would get promoted, not because you were the brother of someone or the cousin of someone else.
Do you think when Kibaki came into power and promised the Kenyan people that he would root up corruption and hire John as the anti-corruption czar, do you think his administration meant they really wanted to do it, but then just succumbed to the tradition of this tribal favoritism? Or do you think John was just naive?
I suspect it's a combination of the two. I think there were a lot of people who did genuinely think that they were doing away with the old sclerotic way of running the country. And then I think they were in power, and I think they began to see dollar signs in their eyes, and they began to realise that there was very little accountability, you know, that you could pretty much get away with anything. And they began to see that their colleagues were buying large villas and going on foreign trips abroad and seemed to have an awful lot of shiny new cars. And suddenly all the sort of the stuff that they had campaigned so vociferously against, suddenly it all became a bit morally fuzzy. And, you know, what they say about absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think that's what happened.
Now, I'm wondering what it is about the character you profile in your book, John Githongo, that made him a whistleblower instead of a partner in crime.
Yes, I think it's a very interesting question, because there are many people who, placed in John Githongo's shoes, would not have made the decisions he made and would have succumbed, maybe unwillingly, regretfully, but still would have succumbed. I think John is someone with a very rigid sense of what is right and wrong. He's a very religious person. He's a devout Catholic. I think that he had been exposed to a very Western education. He'd spent 3 years studying abroad here in Britain. He had a very global, international perspective, and he thought that there were other ways of running the country.
So did John expose the corruption before he fled to Britain, or did he wait till he got to you and then tell the world what was really happening in Kenya?
Well, what he did is he spent a long time trying to get his ministers, the justice minister, the finance minister, the minister for internal security, to act, to sort of deal with these scams, and gradually began to realize that he was talking to the people who were at the very heart of the affair. And he had something like 66 briefings with President Kibaki. And there just came a point where I think the scales fell from his eyes. And he suddenly thought, you know, the reason I'm not having any traction here and nothing's happening is because the president is in on it. He may not be benefiting from it himself, but he's certainly providing cover and protection, and, you know, he's complicit by his silence. At that point, he fled to my place, and he spent a year sort of compiling evidence, because what really makes this case so extraordinary and so different is that John had gathered a huge amount of evidence for what he'd seen taking place under his watch, and that included these recordings that he had secretly made during many incriminating conversations with those involved in the scam. And so he had brought all that stuff to Britain, and then when he had that dossier ready, he went public with it.
Now, I'm assuming it was very dangerous for him to stay inside Kenya and do that. Is that why he had to do it abroad?
He certainly felt he was doing it for that reason, but afterwards he told me that he realized that he needed physically to leave the country just to get a distance from the story, that he had just lost his sense of perspective and couldn't really work out what was going on anymore, who was right, who was wrong, what he felt about all these people who were nudging and pressurizing him and telling him what to do, and he didn't feel it was right. I think he just needed the calm of distance. But that he was in danger, I think, is also true. I mean, he was getting a lot of anonymous death threats, and a lot of death threats that were sort of passed on with a kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, hearty laughter. It's kind of like, oh, John, you know, if you carry on like that, well, you won't be around for much longer. So you could never tell how serious they were. But when you've heard that a couple of times from people in top positions, you begin to get very worried, I think.
And I understand that when he came out with his information, when he finally told the world what was happening in Kenya, he was simultaneously the most hated and most admired man in Kenya. How so?
Well, I think he's become a great hero to certainly young Kenyans who look at him and they think, this is a man who had every reason to join the system, shut up, take a nice big backhander, keep quiet and just, you know, play the game. He didn't. And he represents a kind of urban, cosmopolitan, non-tribal Kenyan that increasingly, I think, youngsters in Kenya see that's the way we've got to go. He's loathed and detested from members of that urban elite from his own ethnic community, the Kikuyu community. In their eyes, he betrayed them. Yes, he may have discovered some unsavory things. They never seem to question whether or not what he found out was true or not. But they just say, you don't betray the tribe. You know, you don't go in and wash your dirty laundry in public. And you don't go abroad and do it in front of white people, especially you don't go and do it in front of white British people, because there's a lot of prickliness about the British role in Kenyan history.
So what difference did this make? I mean, he put his life on the line, he put his career on the line to tell the truth about what he saw inside the Kenyan government. Did it bring about any change?
I think it's brought about a very amorphous and slightly intangible change. But if you look at, if you're looking for solid, concrete results, it hasn't resulted in any prosecutions. There's total impunity still on Anglo leasing. There's total impunity on a whole series of corruption scandals in Kenya today. And I don't believe that anyone will ever be prosecuted for Anglo leasing. So in that respect, it's been a complete failure. But when I talk to Kenyans now, I think that there's such an awareness now, there's such a feeling of exasperation and frustration with the existing political structure and the existing political elite in that country, and such a deep desire to change the system. And I think that the John Githongo story of this tale of one man who stood up and said, hey, I'm not going to play this game, I think that's a source of inspiration. And there are an awful lot of people who work in Kenya, in the media, in the churches, in civil society, in the human rights organizations. And they are also, like John, all standing up and saying, you know, we have to change this. We cannot keep running the country as though it's for all for the benefit of one small tribal elite, whichever tribal elite of the day it happens to be. And I think he contributed to that in a big way.
Can you update us on John's story now? What has happened since your book has come out, since he's made these revelations? Where is he now and what's he going to do?
John went back to Kenya about the time that my book was first published in Britain. He went back to Kenya permanently. He had a few sort of trial returns just to see what the temperature was like there. And he was returning after an election, this massive, violent, turbulent election, which in a way really highlighted all the issues that he felt, you know, his own departure, his own exile had also brought to the fore. I think he felt that the coalition government that had been put in place with the urging of Kofi Annan was more likely to be
sort of conducive to his return. And he is there now. He's he went to spend a lot of time in the communities that have been most traumatized by this election violence that broke out after the polls in 2007. And he's really doing a lot of grassroots work and trying to kind of heal the rifts, because really what we saw with those elections was that it's our turn to eat philosophy suddenly reached its peak and exploded into violence, because, you know, there was an attempt to rig the elections by the ruling party. And, you know, the people who were voting for the opposition said, not this time. We're not going to be left out in the cold. And so John, I think, feels that he wants to be back in Kenya, that there's another election coming up in 3 years' time. There are a lot of scars now left by that violence. He wants to do what he can to try and heal those.
You've covered many African countries and the role corruption plays in some of these places. But I'm wondering if John's story, his whistleblower story, gives you any hope that people may start speaking up and having the courage to confront this system.
Yes, well, I'm a pessimist by nature. I think a lot of journalists are. I think the proof is going to be in the pudding in Kenya. I'm very worried about the next few years. The next 5 years, really. But in the long term, I think I'm quite optimistic, because what you're seeing in places like Kenya is a young generation coming through. Something like 70% of the Kenyan population is now under the age of 35. And these people don't have the same attitudes as the Kibakis of this world. They're young, they're very tuned in, they use the internet all the time, they all own mobile phones, and they tend not to think of themselves in the same tribal terms as their fathers. Others did and their uncles did. And I think they all have a lot more in common with John Githongo than they have in common with Mwai Kibaki. So I think, you know, long term, the continent is going to undergo a massive change as this generation, not just in Kenya, but all around the continent, they take power and they start running things in a very different way.
Makela Wrong is author of It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower. Makela, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You've heard a lot about the swine flu epidemic, but what about the little boy who started it? We'll meet him next on the World Vision Report, the show that brings you close to the lives of people in the developing world. I'm Peggy Waymire, and this is the World Vision Report. Hardly a day goes by when you turn on your local news and don't hear about the swine flu. But it's only been a few months since swine flu media fever broke out, and little Edgar Hernandez was at the center of it. He's the boy who had the first confirmed case of swine flu. Edgar, who's now 5, lives in the rural village of La Gloria in Mexico's Veracruz state. He became a celebrity of sorts with appearances on radio and TV, but things haven't gone well for Edgar and his family since the headlines died down. Reporter Susana Cejas recently traveled to La Gloria and met Edgar and his family.
Traveling to La Gloria feels like traveling back in time. The main road connecting it to El Perote, a town known for its pork production, is mostly dirt, dotted with the occasional donkey and one or two lonely sheep herders. Once in La Gloria, there's a very dusty main street, and off the main square, there's a new statue dedicated to Edgar. It was built and paid for by a local Veracruz sculptor.
Con permiso, ¿no sabe dónde vive el niño Edgar?
I ask a woman selling tortillas, ¿dónde vive Edgar? Where is Edgar?
A la derecha.
Okay, gracias.
La Gloria is a small place, and everyone here knows where he lives. By the time I find Edgar's mother near the local clinic, she knew why I was there. The mother of two looks older than her 34 years, her face lined and sun-beaten. Maria del Carmen Hernandez didn't want to speak to me. She told me the media had misinterpreted her family and she had had enough. After some thought, she walks me to their unpainted cement house, 2 blocks from the main square. Inside, Edgar is playing with his younger brother, Federico.
Oye, ¿y qué pasó? ¿Tú estabas muy enfermo de la influenza?
Sí.
When I asked him what it was like to have swine flu, Edgar sniffles, lies down, and then flashes a wide smile. I ask Edgar's mother what these past few months have been like.
Now everything is fine, if you mean regarding the illness, all is fine. But things change for us a lot.
That's Edgar interrupting his mother to say, they say we are dirty and that we are pigs.
They call us names, they humiliate us. People tell my husband, why do you need work? You've got money now. People say that the governor bought us a house in Veracruz, that he bought us a car, when the reality is different. It's very sad. It makes me angry.
I'm taken aback when Maria breaks down. She tells me people here resent the family because of what happened. During the worst of the outbreak, people from La Gloria would travel to Mexico City on business and be turned back, all because of Edgar, they say. Before the swine flu outbreak, her husband, a day laborer, always had work. Maria tells me they've been forced to eat at a government soup kitchen. The next day, I visit Fidel Herrera Beltrán, the governor of Veracruz, in the state capital, Jalapa. I wanted to see how his government was preparing for a likely outbreak of the flu in the fall and to ask him about the situation Edgar's family is in. The governor, dressed in a sharp navy blue suit, denies that La Gloria was the site of the origin of the H1N1 outbreak.
We have other risks. More people die of dengue fever and diabetes here. It seems that we had a virus of disinformation, and that caused us more harm than the actual virus.
And then I ask him about Edgar's family and the discrimination they face.
It's good that the foreign independent media tells me this.
He says that with more than a little sarcasm in his voice. When I go back to La Gloria a week later, I find that Edgar's house has been painted and a new sidewalk has been built to keep their home from flooding.
Buenas tardes, señora. ¿Cómo ha estado?
I head to Edgar's house and find Maria outside, sweeping. She tells me the governor has given them some financial support. Then she says thank you and unexpectedly slams a door in my face.
Le agradezco mucho, de verdad.
I understand now that one more reporter on her doorstep would just bring her family more attention, when all they really want is to get back to life the way it was before swine flu.
Susana Cejas is a freelance reporter based in Mexico City. Child trafficking is a serious problem in the developing world. A report released in Australia last month says that 1.2 million children are trafficked for sexual exploitation or cheap labor every year. The plight of trafficked children captured the attention of Gary Haugen, a former attorney with the U.S. Department of Justice. He set up an organization called the International Justice Mission. It sends teams of attorneys and local police into brothels and factories where children are being held. They literally rescue the kids. We spoke with Gary about what his organization is doing to stop child trafficking.
What we do is four things. We provide relief for the victims so that they're actually protected from the abuse. We bring the perpetrators to justice so that they just don't go hurt other people. They're actually sent to jail. Third, we provide long-term victim aftercare for those victims of abuse. And then fourth, we help actually fix that broken public justice system so the poor are not abused anymore.
Now, your organization, IJM, has gotten a lot of attention for your dramatic rescue work, where you actually go in, often in the middle of the night, and rescue these children from brothels. Can you tell us how a rescue actually works? Walk us through such a rescue?
Yeah, the way this happens is that it begins with an undercover investigation that actually finds where the children are being held and how they're being abused. And then, of course, we don't have any authority or capacity to bring rescue to those kids, so we have to work with local law enforcement to be able to mobilize a raid. And so what we do is we take our very careful, professional evidentiary proofs to authorities that we have built a relationship with and with whom we can trust, and then we conduct a raid with them to be able to actually get those children out. Now, usually this is a special police unit that we've been working with, that we've been training, that we've been working with local authorities to make sure that it's not corrupt. And then we work with this special unit to be able to get those children out. But then that really is just the beginning of the process. The rescue is just the beginning, because we then have the task of providing aftercare for those kids that many times lasts for many, many years. In fact, I was just visiting last summer the children that we rescued 5 years ago in Cambodia, and seeing them now in school, seeing them now well cared for half a decade later. So this is a long process of restoration, but it's also a long process of bringing the perpetrators to justice. Because if you don't send the perpetrators and traffickers to jail, they're just going to fill up the brothels with more children.
Many of these countries in the developing world that we're talking about aren't only in need of a system of legal order, that they are simply very corrupt. And I'm wondering, how can you really overhaul a justice system when the people in charge benefit from it not changing, and the citizens affected by it might consider a bribe just the cost of doing business?
Yeah, this is the important insight, to realize that for many people in the developing world, the police are not the people that you run to for protection. They're the people you run from for protection. In other words, the UN came out with a report just last year that made the stunning statement that most poor people in the world actually live outside the protection of law. In other words, if you just pause for a moment and think about what would it mean that if you could not appeal to anyone to protect you when you were being attacked, when your daughter was being raped, when your land was being stolen from you. But the truth is that corruption can be cured. And the marvelous thing about police is they can actually be cleaned up quite efficiently because they're in a command structure. And if the leadership wants to change the culture of that police force, they can. They just have to have the will to do so.
Well, this is kind of a massively tall order. What kind of difference have you been able to document that your organization has made so far? I mean, where would you see the tangible results here?
Well, there's several places now that we've been working long enough where we can actually see the level of victimization begin to be dramatically reduced. For instance, we worked in three targeted cities in northern Thailand addressing the problem of sex trafficking of children. And after about 6.5, almost 7 years of steady work with local law enforcement, we were able to see children in the commercial sex trade reduced by more than 90% over about a 7-year period of time.
Well, how'd you do that?
Well, we simply made it too costly for the traffickers to try to run their business with children. Because you're going to have a commercial sex industry. The question is, do you use children in the midst of it? And we're starting to see that in various places around the world. In Cambodia now, when I was there in 2003, you could go into places and there'd just be hundreds of children on open sale to foreign pedophiles and sex tourists. And now IJM has been training the local authorities for the last 5 years almost now on how to do these enforcement actions on their own. And we are seeing very clear indications that the victimization of children is being reduced and the local authorities are being equipped to do this work themselves. The poor can make a future for themselves if they are simply given protection, if they are simply given a playing field that's fair, because if you're not safe, nothing else matters.
Gary Haugen with the International Justice Mission, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Peggy.
Gary Haugen is founder of International Justice Mission. He joined us from Washington, D.C. And you can find a link to International Justice Mission on our website, worldvisionreport.org. We're taking you now to a working-class neighborhood on the outskirts of Cochabamba, Bolivia. By day, it looks like little more than a washed-out collection of brick houses, dusty plazas, and tired vendors. After dark, many residents are afraid to walk down the street. It's the last place you'd think of finding an art center. But reporter Annie Murphy found one, alive and humming. She brings us this story.
On a recent Friday night in Villa Coronilla, the streets are practically empty, minus a few people buying roast chicken and some mechanics having a beer outside their shop. But there is a hot spot in town tonight, and to find it, just follow the sound of the music. There's a music festival going on, and there's a band for anyone's taste, everything from folk to punk rock. The festival is taking place behind a tall iron gate surrounding a complex of 16 buildings and exposition spaces. Hundreds of people gather in this art center, wandering through colonial structures of thick stone, now converted into galleries and theaters, or they dance in front of an outdoor music stage. It's the fourth anniversary of the center, known as the Matadero, a play on the Spanish word for slaughterhouse, matadero, and the word for art. Earlier in the day, Janeth Arnez, one of the center's founders, gave a tour of the space, including a dark, low-ceilinged room used as a theater.
Esta sala tiene historia.
This room has history. When this was a slaughterhouse, this is the room where they hung up the butchered cow heads. And at one time, this was also used for detaining and torturing people who were against the military dictatorships in the 70s and 80s.
The complex was abandoned for several decades, the adobe crumbling and the ceilings caving in, until a motley group of Bolivian and international artists petitioned the city to use it and refurbish the entire place with their own labor. Their goal? Democratize art with a hands-on space accessible to everyone. But to start, they had to get locals inside the door. The first to come were curious young people, like 21-year-old Milenka Ramos, a local poet who's now a regular.
Frankly, I believe without Matadero, I wouldn't have any options. Nowhere else is like the Matadero, because here you can do 100,000 things. All you have to do is ask for the performance space, and they give it to you. All you have to do is ask for a workshop or seminar, and they provide it. It's simply a marvelous place.
Bolivia is a poor country, which means things like the arts often get short shrift. And there is no other place in Bolivia that comes close to the Matadero. A typical month here might include a dozen workshops, another dozen plays, performances, and film screenings, and various exhibits, all of it low-cost or free, and staffed by volunteers. 7-year-old Ricardo Espada lives 5 blocks away from the Matadero and comes here almost every day. Today, he's taking a small Italian class. The walls here are covered in a vibrant patchwork of drawings done by the kids, and the room is filled with books, art supplies, and musical instruments. After Italian, Ricardo is eager to move on to a music lesson. Today, the students are practicing harmonies. Ricardo seems to have been inspired by these classes.
Ser cantante del soldado.
He says, I want to be a singer. This is Ricardo's first experience with foreign languages or music. His father is a construction worker and his mother, Nidia, is a secretary. Nidia says it took a while for the Matadero to catch on here, because many people saw art as elite, so they didn't see its place in their neighborhood.
Like anywhere in the world, sometimes people just don't want progress. But I've come to like the Matadero for the activities they have, and because the kids in this neighborhood need a space so that they can continue to grow, learn how to be social and respectful of the neighborhood. The sort of kids who understand what art is really about.
Dani Cotillas, who helps organize events at the Matadero, says neighborhood residents like Nidia are crucial to getting people involved in the arts.
More and more, the mothers realize that this is really good for their children. So we have this group of women from the neighborhood who goes to the schools and who talk with the other neighbor, saying, hey, listen, this is very good. You know, this is like they are doing a great job with our children. They are doing really good things. So I think that is the best advertising you can do.
Still, some residents continue to view the space with suspicion. Doña Carmen Reboyo owns a restaurant around the corner. Around here, she says, what we really need are stores. The space could have been a supermarket, perhaps a department store. And, she adds, I don't go to the center because it just doesn't appeal to me. It's always full of young people dressed in black, as if it were some sort of uniform. They look like Satan worshippers to me. However, Carmen isn't against the arts in general. She lets this group of indigenous musicians play in her restaurant during the lunch hour. As for their next venue, the group's members say they want to play at the Matadero. For the World Vision Report, I'm Annie Murphy in Cochabamba, Bolivia.
Por tenerte,
If you head to the highlands of Bolivia, you'll find the fast-growing city of El Alto. It's just on the outskirts of the capital, La Paz, and nearly a million people live there. Many of the residents came from rural areas in hope of finding work and a better life. Instead, they found urban poverty, marked by alcoholism, domestic violence, and discrimination. Local hip-hop artists are now telling the stories of El Alto's people. Reporter Kira Neal sent us this audio postcard of some hip-hop artists at work. And that's it for this week. Remember, we have slideshows and blogs on our website. And we have details on how to become a friend of the World Vision Report on Facebook. The address is worldvisionreport.org. Our show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. And I'm Peggy Wehmeyer.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in the show are not necessarily those of the organization. Chega cansado, oxalá. É bom viver. Água de beber, beberá. Que nem água de coco. Cheiro de querer, camará. É perfume no corpo. Pra quem gosta do vento, ventará. Pra quem gosta de chuva, choverá. Pra quem gosta de lua, luará. Pra quem quer dia claro, sol virá. Gosto de ficar imaginando o que os teus olhos me pedem. Essa preguiça espreguiçando de amor.